As the doors continued to open, we were able to make out perhaps 30 seculars who had gathered to watch. Several were planted facing the gate, all sharing the same awkward stance. After a while, I figured out that these were aiming spelecaptors at us, or holding up gijas to send feeds to people far away. A small child sat on her father's shoulders, eating something. She was already bored and wriggling to be let down. He bent and twisted at the hips and insisted through clenched teeth that she watch, just for another minute. 8 children in identical clothes stood in a row, watched over by a lady. These must have come from one of the burgers' souvens. A desolate woman, looking as though she had survived a natural disaster that hadn't touched anyone else, walked slowly toward the gate, carrying a bundle that I suspected was a newborn infant. 6 men and women were gathered around something that smoked. This artifact was surrounded by a loose revetment of large, brightly colored boxes, on which some of them sat, the better to eat their enormous, drooling sandwiches. Half-forgotten fluckish words came to me. Barbecue. Cooler. Cheeseburg. 1 man had planted himself in a disc of open space, or perhaps the others were just avoiding him, and was waving a banner on the end of a pole. The flag of the secular power. His posture was defiant, triumphant. Another man shouted into a device that made his voice louder, some sort of deolator, I guessed, who wanted us to join his ark. The first to enter were a man and woman dressed in the kinds of clothes that people wore extramuros to attend a wedding or make an important commercial transaction, and 3 children in miniature renditions of those clothes. The man was towing behind him a red wagon carrying a pot with a sapling growing out of it. Each of the children had a hand on the rim of the pot so that it wouldn't topple as the wagon's wheels felt their way over the cobbles. The woman, unencumbered, moved faster, but in a gait that looked all wrong, until I recollected that women extramuros wore shoes that made them walk so. She was smiling, but also wiping tears from her eyes. She headed straight for Grand Sœur Alma, whom she seemed to recognize, and began explaining that her father, who had died 3 years ago, had been a great supporter of the consent and liked to go in the day gate to attend lectures and read books. When he had died, his grandchildren had planted this tree, and now they hoped to see it transplanted to a suitable location on our grounds. Grand Sœur Alma said that that would be fine, provided it was of the 164. The burger lady assured Alma that, knowing our rules, they had gone to all sorts of trouble to make sure that this was so. Meanwhile, her husband was prowling around, taking pictures of this conversation with a gee-jaw. Seeing that we had not massacred the burger family or inserted probes into their orifices, a young assistant to the man with the sound amplification device came in and began to approach us one by one, handing us leaves with writing on them. Unfortunately, they were in kinograms, and so we could not read them. We had been warned that it was best to accept such things politely and claim we would read them later, not engage such persons in Tellenian dialogue. This man noticed the desolate woman. Guessing that she meant to leave her baby with us, he began trying to talk her out of it in slangy fluckish. She recoiled, then, understanding that she was probably safe, began cursing at him. 6 sewers moved forward to surround her. The deolator became furious and looked as if he might strike someone. I noticed Fra Degelos for the first time, watching this fellow closely and making eye contact with several burly fras who were moving closer to him. But then the man with the sound device chirped out a word that must have been the younger fellow's name. Having got his attention, he looked up at the sky for a moment. "The powers that be are watching, idiot," then glared at him. "Simmer down and keep handing out the all-important literature." A tall man was walking toward me. Artisan Quinn. Next to him was a shorter copy of Quinn without the beard.
"Bon appert, Fra Erasmus," Quinn said.
"Bon appert, Artisan Quinn," I returned, and then looked at his son. His son was looking at my left foot. His gaze traveled quickly up to the top of my hood, but did not catch or linger on my face, as if this were of no more note than a wrinkle in my bolt. "Bon," I began, but he interrupted.
That bridge is built on the arch principle.
Barb, the Fra's wishing you bon appert, said Quinn, and held out his hand in my direction. But Barb actually reached out and pulled his father's arm down. It was blocking his view of the bridge.
The bridge has a catenary curve because of the vectors, Barb went on.
Catenary, that's from the Orth word for, I began.
It's from the Orth word for chain, Barb announced. It is the same curve that a hanging chain makes, flipped upside down, but the drive shaft that opens the gates has to be straight, unless it was made with new matter.
His eyes found my sphere and studied it for a few moments.
But that can't be because the Consent of Sant Edhar was built after the first sack, so it must have been made with old matter.
His eyes went back to the drive shaft, which seemed to follow the arch of the bridge, passing through blocks of carved stone at regular intervals.
Those stone things must contain universal joints, he concluded.
That is correct, I said.
The shaft is put together from 8 straight pieces connected by universal joints hidden inside the bases of those statues. The base of a statue is called a plinth.
And Barb began to walk very fast. He was the first extra to cross over the bridge into our math. Quinn gave me a look that was difficult to interpret and hustled after him. An altercation had flared up between the desolate woman and the sewers. Apparently this woman had been told by some ignorant person that we'd give her money for the baby. The sewers had set her straight as gently as they knew how. Several more extras had come in. A group of 6, mostly men, all wearing clothes that were respectful but not expensive. They had engaged a small group of mostly older avowed. The foremost of the visitors was draped in a thick, gaudy colored rope with a globe at the end. I reckoned he was the priest of some newfangled counter-Bayesian arc. He was talking to Fra Haligastrim, big, bald, burly, and bearded, looking as if he had just stepped off the paracline after a brief discussion of ontology with Telenes. He was a theoretical geologist and the FAE of the Edharian chapter. He was listening politely but kept throwing significant glances at a pair of purple-bolted hierarchs standing off to the side. Degalos, the warden fendant, and Statho, the primate. Circumventing this group, I passed an earshot of a side conversation. One of the women visitors had engaged Fra Jesri. I put her age at about 30, though the way that Extramuros women did their hair and faces made it difficult to guess such things. On second thought, she was a dressed-up 25. She was paying close attention to Jesri, asking him questions about life in the math. After what seemed like a long time, I got Jesri's attention. He politely told the woman that he had made arrangements to go Extramuros with me. She looked at me, which I enjoyed. Then her G-jaw spat out a burst of notes, and she excused herself to take a call.
Sline. 1. In Fleckish of the late Praxic Age and early Reconstitution, a slang word formed by truncation of baseline, which is a Praxic commercial bullshit term. It appears to be a noun that turned into an adjective meaning common or widely shared. 2. A noun denoting an extramuros person with no special education, skills, aspirations, or hope of acquiring same. 3. Derogatory term for a stupid or uncouth person, especially one who takes pride in those very qualities. Note, this sense is deprecated because it implies that a slyne is a slyne because of inherent personal shortcomings or perverse choices. Sense 2 is preferred because it does not convey any such implication. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Jesri and I walked out for the first time in 10 years. The first thing I noticed was that people had leaned a lot of junk against the outside of our walls. Apparently, some of it had even been leaned against the gates, but someone had cleared it off to the sides in preparation for Appert. During this era, the neighborhood outside the Decade Gate was where artisans kept their shops, and so the stuff leaned against the wall tended to be lumber, pipes, reels of cable or tubing, and long-handled tools. We walked silently for a while, just looking. But sooner than you might think, we got used to it and forgot we were Fra's.
"Do you think that woman wanted to have a liaison with you?"
I asked. What do you call it? An Atlanean liaison. Named after a decenarian frog of the 17th century AR, who saw his true love for 10 days every 10 years and spent the rest of the time writing poems to her and sneaking them out of the math. They were really fine poems, carved in stone some places. Why do you think a woman would want that? He wondered. Well, no risk of getting pregnant when your partner is a fraud, I pointed out. That might be important sometimes, but I think it's easy for them to obtain contraception in this epoch. I was kind of joking. Oh, sorry. Well, maybe she wants me for my mind. Or your spiritual qualities. Huh? You think she's some kind of diolater? Didn't you see who she was with? Some sort of, who knows, a contingent, I think is what they call that. Those were Warden of Heaven people, I'll bet. Their leader was got up in a kind of imitation of a cord. We had gone far enough that the Decade Gate was lost to view around a curve. I glanced up at the Presidium. The megaliths, rising up from the perimeter of the Starhenge, served as compass points to help me establish my bearings. We had come to a larger road now, running roughly parallel to the river. If we crossed it and kept going, we'd climb into a neighborhood of big houses where burghers lived. If we followed it to the right, it would take us to the Commerce District, and we could eventually loop back in through the Daygate. To the left, it ran out into the Faubourgs, where I had spent my first 8 years. Let's get this over with, I said, and turned left. After we had gone a few paces, Jezri said, Again? Which was his annoying way of requesting clarification. The Warden of Heaven? Moshianics, I said, and then spent a while telling him about Fra Orlo's interviews with Fleck and Quinn. As we went along, the nature of the place changed. Fewer workshops, more warehouses. Barges could navigate this stretch of the river, and so it was where people tended to store things. We saw more vehicles now, a lot of Drummonds, which had up to a dozen wheels and were used for carrying large, heavy objects around districts like this. These looked the same as I remembered. A few fetches scurried around with smaller loads secured to their backs. These were more colorful. The men who owned them tended to be artisans, and it was clear that they spent a lot of time altering the vehicle's shape and color, apparently for no reason other than to amuse themselves. Or maybe it was a kind of competition, like plumage on birds. Anyway, the styles had changed quite a bit, and so Jezri and I would stop talking and stare whenever a particularly strange or gaudy fetch went by. Their drivers stared right back at us. Well, I was oblivious to all that Warden of Heaven stuff, Jezri concluded. I've been very busy computing for Orlo's group. Why did you think Tamara was drilling us last night? I asked. I didn't think about it, Jezri said. All I can say is it's good you are around to be aware of all this. Have you considered joining the new circle, angling to become a hierarch? Yeah. No, I don't have to, because everyone else seems to be considering it for me. Sorry, Raz, he said, not really sounding sorry, more miffed that I had become miffed. He was hard to talk to, and sometimes I'd go months avoiding him. But slowly I'd learned it could be worth the aggravation. Forget it, I said. What have Orlo's group been up to? I've no idea. I just do the calculations, orbital mechanics. The Oracle or totally praxic? You think they have found a planet around another star? How could that be? For that, they have to collate information from other telescopes, and we haven't got anything in 10 years, obviously. So it's something nearer, I said. Something that can be picked out with our telescopes. It's an asteroid, Jezri said, fed up with my slow progress on the riddle. Is it the Big Nugget? Orlo would be a lot more excited in that case. This was a very old joke. The Pangendrums had almost no use for us, but one of the few things that might change that would be the discovery of a large asteroid that was about to hit Arb. In 1107, it had almost happened. Thousands of Avowed had been brought together in a convox that had built a spaceship to go nudge it out of the way. but by the time the ship had been launched in 1115, the cosmographers had calculated that the rock would just miss us, and so it had turned into a study mission. The lab where they had built the ship was now the consent of Sainte-Rabe, after the cosmographer who had discovered the rock. To our right, the hill where the Burgers lived had petered out. A tributary of the river cut across our path from that direction. The road crossed it on an ancient steel bridge, built, rusted, decayed, condemned, and pasted back together with new matter. A dotted line, worn away to near invisibility, hinted to motorists that they might consider showing a little civility to pedestrians between the rightmost lane and the railing. It was a bit late for us to double back now, and we could see another pedestrian pushing a cart piled high with polybags, so we hustled over as quickly as we could manage, trusting the Drummonds, Fetches, and Mobes not to strike us dead. To our left, we could see the tributary winding through its floodplain toward the join with the main river a mile away. When I had been younger, the angle between the two watercourses had been mostly trees and marsh, but it looked as though they had put up a levee to fend off high water and then shingled it with buildings. Most obviously, a large roofless arena with thousands of empty seats. "Shall we go watch a game?" Fra Jesri asked. I couldn't tell whether he was serious. Of all of us, he looked the most like an athlete. He didn't play sports often, but when he did, he was determined and angry, and tended to do well, even though he had few skills. "I think you need money to get in. Maybe we could sell some honey." "We don't have any of that either. Maybe later in the week." Jesri did not seem very satisfied with my answer. "It's too early in the morning for them to be having a game," I added. A minute later, he had a new proposal. "Let's pick a fight with some slines." We were almost to the end of the bridge. We had just scurried out of the path of a fetch operated by a man about our age who drove it as if he had been chewing jumpweed, with one hand on the controls and the other pressing a G-jaw to the side of his face. So we were physically excited, breathing rapidly, and the idea of getting into a fight seemed a tiny bit less stupid than it would have otherwise. I smiled and considered it. Jesri and I were strong from winding the clock, and many of the extras were in terrible condition. I understood now what Quinn had meant when he had said that they were starving to death and dying from being too fat at the same time. When I looked back at Jesri, he scowled and turned his face away. He didn't really want to get into a fight with slines. We had entered into the Faubourg where I had come from. A whole block had been claimed by a building that looked like a megastore but was apparently some new counter-Bayesian arc. In the lawn before it was a white statue, 50 feet high, of some bearded prophet holding up a lantern and a shovel. The roadside ditches were full of jumpweed and slashberry poking up through sediments of discarded packaging. Beneath a gray film of congealed exhaust, faded kinograms fidgeted like maggots trapped in a garbage bag. The kinograms, the logos, the names of the snacks were new to me, but in essence it was all the same. I knew now why Jesri was being such a jerk. "It's disappointing," I said.
"Yeah,"
Jesri said. "All these years reading the chronicles and hearing strange tales told every day at Provener, I guess it sort of
raised our expectations,"
he said.
"Yeah."
Something occurred to me. "Did Orlo ever talk to you about the 10,000ers?
Causal domain shear and all that?"
Jesri looked at me funny, surprised that Orlo had confided in me. I nodded.
"That is a classic example of the crap they feed us to make it seem more exciting than it really is."
But I sensed Jesri had only just decided this. If Orlo was talking to all the Fids about it, how special could it be? "They're not feeding us crap, Jesri. It's just that we live in boring times." He tried a new tack.
"It's a recruiting strategy, or to be precise, a retention strategy."
"What does that mean?"
"Our only entertainment is waiting for the next appert, to see what's out there when the gates open. When the answer turns out to be the same crap except dirtier and uglier, what can we do besides sign up for another 10 years and see if it's any different next time?"
"Or go in deeper.
Become a hundreder?" Haven't you realized that's worthless for us?
Because their next apert is our next apert, I said.
And then we die before the next one after that.
It's not that rare to live to 130, I demurred.
Which only proved that I had done the same calculation in my head and come to the same conclusion as Jessery.
He snorted.
You and I were born too early to be hunderders and too late to be thousanders. A couple of years earlier and we might have been foundlings and gone straight to the crag.
In which case we'd both die before seeing an apert, I said.
Besides, I might have been a foundling, but from what you've said of your birth family, I don't think you'd have.
We'll see soon enough, he said.
We covered a mile in silence. Even though we didn't say anything, we were in dialogue. A peregrine dialogue, meaning two equals wandering around trying to work something out, as opposed to a Suvinian dialogue, where a fid is being taught by a mentor, or a Periclinian dialogue, which is combat. The road dovetailed into a larger one, lined with the mass-produced businesses where slines obtained food and stuff, enlivened by casinos, windowless industrial cubes wrapped in colored light. Back in some day when there had been more vehicles, the full width of the right-of-way had been claimed by striped lanes. Now there were a lot of pedestrians and people getting around on scooters and wheeled planks and pedal-powered contraptions. But instead of going in straight lines, they and we had to stitch together routes joining the pavement slabs that surrounded the businesses, as the sea surrounds a chain of islands. The slabs were riven with meandering cracks marked by knife-thin hedges of jumpweed that had been straining dirt and wrappers out of the wind for a long time. The sun had gone behind clouds shortly after dawn, but now it came out again. We ducked into the shade of a business that sold tires of different colors to young men who wanted to prettify their fetches and their souped-up mobs, and spent a minute rearranging our bolts to protect our heads.
You want something, I said. You're grumpy you don't have it yet.
I don't think that what you want is stuff, because you've paid no attention at all to any of this. I jerked my head at a display of iridescent new matter tires. Moving pictures of naked women with distended breasts came and went on the sides of the wheels. Jessery watched one of the moving pictures for a while, then shrugged.
I suppose I could leave and learn to like such things. Frankly, it seems pretty stupid. Maybe it helps if you eat what they eat.
We moved on across the pavement slab.
Look, I said.
It's been understood at least since the Praxic Age that if you have enough Allswell floating around in your bloodstream, your brain will tell you in 100 different ways that everything is all right.
And if you don't, you end up like you and me, he said.
I tried to become angry, then surrendered with a laugh.
All right, I said.
Let's go with that. A minute ago, we passed a stand of blithe in the median strip.
I saw it too, and the one by the pre-owned pornography store.
That one looked fresher. We could go pick it and eat it, and eventually the level of Allswell in our blood would go up and we could live out here or anywhere and feel happy. Or we could go back to the consent and try to come by our happiness honestly.
You are so gullible, he said.
You're supposed to be the Adharian's golden boy, I said. You're supposed to be the one who swallows this stuff without question.
I'm surprised, frankly.
And what are you now, Raz? The cynical Prokian?
So people seem to think.
Look, Jessery said.
I see the older of out working hard. Those who have upsight, who are illuminated by the light of Canoas.
He said this in a mocking tone. He was so frustrated that he veered and lunged in random ways as he moved from one thought to the next.
They do theorics. Those who aren't so gifted fall back and cut stone or keep bees. The really miserable ones leave or throw themselves off the minster. Those who remain seem happy, whatever that means.
Certainly happier than the people out here.
I disagree, Jessery said. These people are as happy as, say, Fra Orlo. They get what they want. Naked ladies on their wheels. He gets what he wants. Upside to the mysteries of the universe.
Let's get down to it then. What do you want?
Something to happen, he said. I almost don't care what.
If you made a great advance in theorics, would that count?
Sure, but what are the odds I'll do that?
It depends on the givens coming in from the observatories.
Right. So it's out of my control. What do I do in the meantime?
Study theorics, which you're good at. Drink beer. Have Tivian liaisons with as many sewers as you can talk into it. Why is that so bad?
He was devoting way too much attention to kicking a stone ahead of him, watching it bound across the pavement.
I keep looking at the shrimpy guys in the stained glass windows, he said.
Huh?
You know, in the windows depicting the Saints. The Saints themselves, they're always shown big. They fill most of the window. But if you look close, you can see tiny little figures in bolts and cords huddled around their knees, I said.
Yeah.
Looking up at the Saint adoringly. The helpers, the fids, the second raiders who proved a lemma or read a draft somewhere along the way. No one knows their names, except maybe the cranky old frau who takes care of that one window.
You don't want to end up as a knee-hugger, I said.
That is correct.
How does that work?
Why some, but not others?
So you want a window all to yourself?
It'd mean that something interesting happened to me, he said.
Something more interesting than this.
And if it came to a choice between that and having enough Allswell in your blood?
He thought about that as we waited for a huge articulated Drummond to back out of our way.
Finally, you ask an interesting question, he said.
And after that, he was quite a pleasant companion. Half an hour later, I pronounced us lost. Jesri accepted it with pleasure, as if this were more satisfactory than being found. A boxy vehicle rolled past.
That is the third coach full of children that has gone by us recently, Jesri pointed out. Did you have a Suvin in your neighborhood?
Places like this don't have Suvins, I reminded him. They have stables.
Oh, yes. That comes from, it's an old fluckish word, cultural
stabilization centers. But don't say that, because no one has called them that in something like 3,000 years.
Right. Stables it is.
We turned where the coaches turned. For the next minute or so, things were fragile between us. Inside the math, it didn't matter that he had come from Burgers and I had come from Slines. But as soon as we had stepped out of the decade gate, this fact had been released, like a bubble of swamp gas deep in dark water. Invisibly, it had been rising and expanding ever since, and had just now erupted in a great, flaming, stinking belch. My old stable looked, in my eyes, like a half-scale reproduction of itself thrown together by a sloppy model maker. Some of the rooms had been boarded up. In my day, they had been crowded. So that confirmed that the population was declining. Perhaps by the time I was a Grand Frau, there would be a young forest here. An empty coach pulled out of the drive. Before the next drew up to take its place, I glimpsed a crowd of youngsters staggering under huge backpacks into a canyon of raucously colored light. A breezeway lined with machines dispensing snacks, drinks, and attention-getting noises. From there, they would carry their breakfasts into rooms which Jesri and I could see through windows. In some, the children all watched the same program on a single large screen. In others, each had his or her own panel. To one end, the blank wall of the gymnasium was booming with low-frequency rhythms of a sports program. I recognized the beat. It was the same one they had used when I was there. Jesri and I had not seen moving pictures in 10 years, and so we stood there for a few minutes, hypnotized. But I had got my bearings now. And once I had nudged Jesri back into movement, I was able to lead us down the streets I had wandered as a boy. People here were as keen to modify their houses as their vehicles, and so when I did recognize a dwelling, it would have a new freestanding roof lofted above the old one, or new modules plugged and pasted onto the ones I saw when I dreamed about the place. But I was helped by the fact that the neighborhood was half the size of what I remembered. We found where I had lived before I was collected. 2 shelter modules joined into an L, another L of wire mesh completing a weedy cloister that housed 1 dead mob and 2 dead fetches, the oldest of which I had personally helped set up on blocks. The gate was decorated with 4 different signs of varying ages promising to kill anyone who entered, which to me seemed much less intimidating than a single sign would have. A baby tree, about as long as my forearm, had sprouted from a clogged rain gutter. Its seed must have been carried there by wind or a bird. I wondered how long it would take to grow to a size where it would tear the gutter clean off. Inside, a loud moving picture was showing on a spiele, so we had to do a lot of hallooing and gate-rattling before someone emerged. A woman of about 20. She'd have been a big girl to me when I'd been 8. I tried to remember the big girls' names.
Leah?
She moved away when those guys left, the woman explained, as if hooded men came to her door every day incanting the names of long-lost relations. She glanced back over her shoulder to watch a fiery explosion on the spiele. As the sound of the explosion died away, we could hear a man's voice demanding something. She explained to him what she was doing. He didn't quite follow her explanation, so she repeated the same words more loudly.
I infer that some kind of factional schism has taken place within your family while you were gone, Jezri said.
I wanted to slug him, but when I looked at his face, I saw he wasn't trying to be clever. The woman turned to look at us again. I was peering at her through an aperture between two signs that were threatening to kill me, and I wasn't certain that she could see my face.
I used to be named Vit, I said. The boy who went to the clock, I remember you. How's it going?
Fine. How are you?
Keeping it casual.
Your mama isn't here. She moved.
Far away?
She rolled her eyes, vexed that I had leaned on her to make such a judgment.
Farther than you can probably walk.
The man inside yelled again. She was obliged to turn her back on us again and summarize her activities.
Apparently, she does not subscribe to the dravicular iconography, Jezri said.
How do you figure?
She said you went to the clock, voluntarily, not that you were taken by or abducted by the Avout.
The woman turned to face us again.
I had an older sib named Cord, I said.
I nodded at the oldest of the broken fetches.
Former owner of that. I helped put it there.
The woman had complex opinions of Cord, which she let us know by causing several emotions to ripple across her face. She ended by exhaling sharply, dropping her shoulders, setting her chin, and putting on a smile that I guessed was meant to be obviously fake.
Cord works all the time on stuff.
What kind of stuff? This question was even more exasperating to her than my earlier far away. She looked pointedly at the moving picture.
Where should I look? I tried.
She shrugged.
You passed it on the way, probably.
And she mentioned a place that we had, in fact, passed, shortly after leaving the Decade Gate. Then she took a step back inside because the man in there was demanding an account of her recent doings.
Keep it casual,
she said, and waved, and disappeared from our view.
Now I really want to meet Cord, Jezri said.
Me too. Let's get out of here, I said, and turned my back on the place, probably for the last time, as I didn't imagine I'd come back at next Appert.
Perhaps when I was 78 years old. Reforestation was a surprisingly quick process.
What's a sib? Why do you use that word?
In some families, it's not entirely clear how people are related.
We walked faster and talked less, and got back across the bridge in very little time. Since the place where Cord worked was so close to the consent, we first went up into the Burger neighborhood and found Jezri's house. When we had gone out the Decade Gate, Jezri had been quiet and distracted for a few minutes before he had gone on his rant. Now I had an upsight, which was that he had been expecting his family to be standing in front of the gate to meet him. So as we approached his old house, I actually felt more anxious than I had when approaching mine. A porter let us in at the front gate, and we kicked off our sandals so that the damp grass would clean and soothe our blasted feet. As we passed into the deep shade of the forested belt around the main residence, we threw back our hoods and slowed to enjoy the cool air. No one was home, except for a female servant whose fluckish was difficult for us to make out. She seemed to expect us. She handed us a leaf, not from a leaf tree such as we grew in the consent,
but made by a machine. It seemed like an official document that had been stamped out on a press or generated by a syntactic device. At its head was yesterday's date, but it was actually a personal note written to Jezri by his mother, using a machine to generate the neat rows of letters. She had written it in Orth with only a few errors. She didn't understand how to use the subjunctive. It used terms with which we were not familiar, but the gist seemed to be that Jezri's father had been doing a lot of work, far away, for some entity that was difficult to explain. But from the part of the world it was in, we knew it had to be some organ of the secular power. Yesterday, she had, with great reluctance and some tears, gone to join him, because his career depended on her attending some kind of social event that was also difficult to explain. They had every intention of making it back for the banquet on 10th night, and they were bending every effort to round up Jezri's 3 older brothers and 2 older sisters as well. In the meantime, she had baked him some cookies, which we already knew since the female servant had brought them out to us. Jezri showed me around the house, which felt like a math, but with fewer people. There was even a fancy clock, which we spent a lot of time examining. We pulled down books from the shelves and got somewhat involved in them. Then the bells began to ring in the Bayesian Cathedral across the street, followed by the chimes in the fancy clock, and we realized that we could read books any day, and sheepishly reshelved them. After a while, we ended up on the veranda, eating the rest of the cookies. We looked at the cathedral. Bayesian architecture was a cousin to Mathic, broad and rounded, where ours was narrow and pointy. But this town was not nearly as important to the secular world as the convent of St. Edhar was to the Mathic world, so the cathedral looked puny compared to the minster.
"Do you feel happy yet?" Jezri joked, looking at the cookies.
"It takes 2 weeks," I said. "That's why Appert is only 10 days long." We wandered out onto the lawn. Then we marched back out and headed down the hill. Cord worked in a compound where everything was made of metal, which marked it as an ancient place. Not quite as ancient as a place made of stone, but probably dating back to the middle of the Praxic Age, when steel had become cheap and heat engines had begun to move about on rails. It was situated a quarter of a mile from the Century Gate on the end of a slip that had been dug from the river so that barges could penetrate into this neighborhood and connect to roads and rails. The property was a mess, but it drew a kind of majesty just from being huge and silent. It had been outlined by a fence twice my height, made from sheets of corrugated steel anchored in earth or concrete, welded together, embraced against wind by old worn-out railroad rails, which seemed like overkill for a wind brace. In fact, it was such conspicuous overkill that Jezri and I interrupted each other trying to be the first to point it out and got into an argument about what it meant. Other parts of the perimeter were made of the steel boxes used later in the Praxic Age to enclose goods on ships and trains. Some of these were filled with dirt, others stuffed with scraps of metal so tangled and irregular that they looked organic. Some were organic because they had been colonized by Slashberry. There was a lot of green and growing matter around the edges of the compound, but the center was a corral of pounded earth. The main building was little more than a roof on stilts, straddling the last 200 feet of the canal. Its trusses were oversized to support a traveling crane with a great hook dangling from a rusty chain, each of whose links was as big as my head. We had seen this structure from the minster, but never given much thought to it. Teed into its side was a high-roofed hall, enclosed by proper walls of brick, below, and corrugated steel, above. Grafted to the side of that, down low, was a shelter module with all sorts of homey touches, such as a fake wood door and a farm-style weather vane that looked crazy here. We knocked, waited, then pushed our way in. We made lots of noise, just in case this was another one of those places where visitors were put to death. But no one was there. The module had been designed to serve as a home, but everything in it had been bent to serve the purposes of an office. So, for example, the shower stall was occupied by a tall cabinet where they filed records. A hole had been sawed into a wall so that little pipes could be routed to a hot beverage machine.
A freestanding urinal had been planted in the bedroom. The only decoration, other than those crazy-looking rustic touches that had shipped with the module, was oddly shaped pieces of metal, parts from machines, I reckoned, some of which had been bent or snapped in traumatic events we could only imagine. A trail of oily boot prints led us to the back door. This opened straight into the cavernous hall. Both of us hunched our shoulders as we stepped over the threshold. We hesitated just inside. The place was too big to illuminate, so most of the light was natural, shining through translucent panels high up in the walls, each surrounded by a hazy nimbus. The walls and floors were dark with age, congealed smoke and oil. More hooks and chains dangled from overhead beams. The light washing round these gave them a spindly, eroded look. The floor sprawled away into haze and shadow. Widely spaced around it were crouching masses, some no bigger than a man, others the size of a library. Each was built around a hill of metal. From a distance, smooth and rounded, from up close, rough, which led me to guess that these had been made in the ancient process of excavating molds from sand and pouring in a lake of molten iron. Where it mattered, the rough iron had been cut away to leave planes, holes, and right angles of bare gray metal. Stubby feet by which the castings were bolted to the floor, or long V-shaped ways on which other castings could slide, driven by great screws. Huddled beside these things, or crouching under them, were architectures of wound copper wire, rife with symmetries, and when they moved, brilliant with azure-tinged lightning. Tendrils of wire and of artfully bent tubing had grown over these machines like ivy exploring a boulder, and my eye followed them to concentrations where I was sometimes surprised to see a human being in a dark coverall. Sometimes these humans were doing something identifiable as work, but more often they were just thinking. The machines emitted noise from time to time, but for the most part it was quiet, pervaded by a low hum that came from warm resonating boxes strewn all round and fed by, or feeding, cables as thick as my ankle. There were perhaps half a dozen humans in the entire place, but something in their posture made us not dare approach them. One came our way pushing a rusty cart exploding with wild helices of shaved metal. "Excuse me," I said, "is Cord here?" The man turned and extended his hand toward something big and complicated that stood in the middle of the hall. Above it, the rational adraconic geometry of the roof trusses and the infinitely more complex manifolds of swirling mist were magnified and made more than real by the sputtering blue light of electrical fire. If I saw a star of that color through a telescope, I would know it as a blue dwarf, and I could guess its temperature. Far hotter than our sun, hot enough that much of its energy was radiated as ultraviolet light and X-rays. But paradoxically, the house-sized complex that was the source of the energy looked orange-red, with only a fringe of the killing radiance leaking out round edges or bouncing from slick places on the floor. As Jezri and I drew closer, we perceived it as a giant cube of red amber with two black forms trapped in it. Not insects, but humans. The humans shifted position from time to time, their silhouettes rippling and twisting. We saw that this machine had been robed in a curtain of some red jelly-like matter suspended from an overhead track. The blue light could blast straight up and kill germs in the rafters, but it could not range across the floor and blind people. Obviously, to me and Jezri, the curtain was red because it had been formulated to let only low-energy light, which our eyes saw as red, pass through it. To high-energy light, which we saw as blue, if we could see it at all, it was as opaque as a steel plate. We walked around the perimeter, which was about the size of two small shelter modules parked side by side. Through the red jelly wall, it was difficult to resolve fine details of the machine, but it seemed to have a slab-like table, big enough to sleep 10, that eased to and fro like a block of ice on a griddle. Planted in its center was a smaller circular table that made quick but measured spins and tilts. Suspended above all of this, from a cast-iron bridge, was a mighty construct that moved up and down and that carried the spark gap where the light was born. An arm of tubular steel was thrust forth from the apex of the bridge toward a platform where the two humans stood. Pendant from its end was a box folded together from sheet metal, which looked out of place. It was of a different order of things from the sand-cast iron. Glowing numbers were all over it. It must be full of syntactic processors that measured what the machine was doing or controlled it, or both, for a true syntactic processor would have the power to make decisions based on measurements. Of course, my thought was to turn away and get out of the room, but Jesri was rapt.
"It's okay. It's Appert," he said,
and grabbed my arm to turn me back around. One of the two humans inside said something about the X-axis. Jesri and I looked at each other in astonishment, just to be sure we'd actually heard such a thing. It was like hearing a fry cook speak Middle Orth. Other fragments came through above the sputtering of the machine. Cubic spline, evolute, pylanic interpolation. We could not keep our eyes off the banks of red numbers on the front of the syntactic processor. They were always changing. One was a clock, counting down in hundredths of a second. Others, as we gradually perceived, reflected the position of the table. They were literal transcriptions of the great table's X and Y position, the angles of rotation and tilt of the smaller table in the middle, and the altitude of the sizzling blaster. Sometimes all would freeze except for one. This signaled a simple linear move. Other times, they would all change at once, realizing a system of parametric equations. Jesri and I watched it for half an hour without speaking another word. Mostly I was trying to make sense of how the numbers changed, but also I was thinking of how this place was similar in many respects to the Minster with its sacred clock in the center, in its well of light. Then the clock struck, as it were. The countdown stopped at zero, and the light went out. Cord reached up and threw back the curtain. She peeled off a pair of black goggles and raised one arm to wipe her brow on her sleeve. The man standing next to her, who I gathered was the customer, was dressed in loose black trousers and a black long-sleeved pullover, with a black skullcap on his head. Jesri and I realized at the same moment what he was. We were dumbstruck. Likewise, the Ida saw what we were and took half a step back. His long black beard avalanched down his chest as his mouth fell open. But then he did something remarkable, which was that he mastered the reflex to cringe and scuttle away from us, which had been drilled into him since birth. He thought better of that half-step back. He resumed his former stance and, hard to believe, but Jesri and I agreed on this later, glared at us. Not knowing how to handle this, Jesri and I backed away and stood out of earshot while Cord did one small, quick, necessary chore after another, celebrating some odd of shutting down the machine and making it ready for reuse. The Ida peeled off his skullcap, which was how they covered their heads when they were among their own kind, and drew it out into the slightly mushroomed stovepipe that they wore when they were out and about so that we could identify them from a distance. He then set this back on his head while sending another defiant look our way. Just as we would never let the Ida come into the chancel, he saw it as sacrilege that we would come here, as if we were guilty of a profanation. Perhaps obeying a similar impulse, Jesri and I hooded ourselves. It was almost as if, far from chafing under the stereotype of the sneaky, scheming, villainous Ita, this one was embracing it, taking pride in it, and pushing it as far as he could without actually talking to us. As we waited for Cord and the Ita to conclude their business, I kept thinking of all the ways that this place was similar to the Minster. For example, how I had been taken aback when I had stepped into the hall, so dark and so light at the same time. A voice in my head, the voice of a Prokian pedant, admonished me that this was a Halicarnian way of thinking. For in truth, I was looking at a collection of ancient machines that had no meaning, all syntax, no semantics.
I was claiming I saw a meaning in it. But this meaning had no reality outside of my mind. I had brought it into the hall with me, carrying it in my head, and now I was playing games with semantics by pasting it onto these iron monuments. But the longer I thought about it, the more certain I became that I was having a legitimate upsight. Protus, the greatest fit of Telenes, had climbed to the top of a mountain near Ethras and looked down upon the plain that nourished the city-state and observed the shadows of the clouds and compared their shapes. He had had his famous upsight that while the shapes of the shadows undeniably answered to those of the clouds, the latter were infinitely more complex and more perfectly realized than the former, which were distorted not only by the laws of a spatial dimension, but also by being projected onto terrain that was of irregular shape. Hiking back down, he had extended that upsight by noting that the mountain seemed to have a different shape every time he turned round to look back at it, even though he knew it had but one absolute form, and that these seeming changes were mere figments of his shifting point of view. From there, he had moved on to his greatest upsight of all, which was that these two observations, the one concerning the clouds, the other concerning the mountain, were themselves both shadows cast into his mind by the same greater unifying idea. Returning to the Pericline, he had proclaimed his doctrine that all the things we thought we knew were shadows of more perfect things in a higher world. This had become the essential doctrine of Protism. If Protus could be respected for saying so, then what was wrong with me thinking that our minster and this machine hall were both shadows of some higher thing that existed elsewhere, a sacred place of which they were both shadows, and that cast other shadows in such places as Bayesian arcs and groves of ancient trees? Jezri, meanwhile, had been staring at Cord's machine. Cord had manipulated some controls that had caused the lightning head to retract as far up as it would go and the table to thrust itself forward. She vaulted up onto that steel slab. In small premeditated steps, she came to the part of it that tilted and rotated, which by itself was a machine of impressive size. Before resting her weight on a foot, she would wiggle it to and fro, scattering shards and twists of silver metal to either side. They made glinting music as they found their way to the floor, and some left corkscrews of fine smoke along their paths. A helper approached with an empty cart, a broom, and a shovel, and began pushing the scraps into a pile. "It carves the metal from a block," Jessery said. "Not with a blade, but with an electrical discharge that melts the stuff away."
"More than melts. Remember the color of the light?" I said. "It turns the metal to..."
"Plasma," we said in unison, and Jezri went on. "It just carves off all the bits that aren't wanted." This raised the question of what was wanted. The answer was clamped to the top of the rotating table, a sculpture of silver metal, flowing and curved like an antler, swelling in places to knobs pierced by perfect cylindrical holes. Cord drew a wrench from the thing she was wearing, which seemed more harness than garment, as its chief purpose was to secure tools to her body. She released three vices, put the wrench back in its ordained pocket, threw back her shoulders, bent her knees, made her spine long, raised her hands, and clasped them around two prongs of this thing she had made. It came up off the table. She carried it down off the machine as if it were a cat rescued from a tree, and set it upon a steel cart that looked older than a mountain. The Eda ran his hands over it. His tall hat turned this way and that as he bent to inspect certain details. Then he nodded and exchanged a few words with Cord and pushed the cart off into smoke and quiet.
"It's a part for the clock," Jezri said. "Something must have broken or worn out down in the cellar."
I agreed that the style of the thing reminded me of some parts of the clock, but I shushed him, because I was more interested in Cord just now. She was walking toward us, almost but not quite stepping on strewn shards of metal, wiping her hands on a rag. Her hair was cut short. I thought at first that she was tall, perhaps because that was how I remembered her. In truth, she was no taller than I.
She seemed stocky with all that hardware strapped to her, but her neck and forearms were firm. She drew to within a couple of paces and clanked to a stop and planted herself. She had a quite solid and deliberate manner of standing. She seemed as though she could sleep standing up, like a horse.
"I guess I know who you are," she said to me. "But what is your name?"
"Erasmus now."
"Is that the name of an old saunt?"
"That's right.
I never did get that old fetch to run."
"I know, I just saw it.
Took part of it here to be machined and never left."
She gazed at the palm of her right hand, then looked up at me. I understood this to mean, "My hand is dirty, but I will shake it if you please." I extended my hand and clasped hers. The sound of bells drifted in.
"Thank you for letting us see your machine," I said. "Would you care to see ours?"
"Well, that's Provener. Jessery and I have to go wind the clock."
"I went to Provener one time."
"Today you can see it from where we see it. Bon Appert."
"Bon Appert," she returned.
"Okay, what the heck. I'll come see it." We had to run across the meadow. Cord had left her big tool harness behind at the machine hall, only to reveal a smaller vest-like one that I guessed held the stuff she'd not be without under any circumstances. When we broke into a run, she clanked and jounced for a few paces until she cinched down some straps, and then she was able to keep pace with us as we rushed through the clover. Our meadow had been colonized by seculars who were having midday picnics. Some were even grilling meat. They watched us run by as if our being late were a performance for their amusement. Children were chivied forward for a better view. Adults trained spiele captors on us and laughed out loud to see us caring so much. We came in the meadow door, ran upstairs into a wardroom where stacks of dusty pews and altars were shoved against the walls, and nearly tripped over Leo and Archibald. Leo was sitting on the floor with his legs doubled under him. Archibald sat on a short bench, knees far apart, leaning forward so that the blood streaming from his nostrils would puddle neatly on the floor. Leo's lip was puffy and bleeding. The flesh around his left eye was ochre, suggesting it would be black tomorrow. He was staring into a dim corner of the room. Archibald let out a shuddering moan as if he had been sobbing and was just now managing it.
"Fight?" I asked.
Leo nodded.
"Between the two of you, or—"
Leo shook his head.
"We were set upon,"
Archibald proclaimed, shouting at his blood puddle.
"Intra or extra?"
Jezri demanded.
"Extra muros. We were en route to my pater's basilica. I wished only to learn whether he would speak to me. A vehicle drove by once, twice, thrice. It circled us like a lowering raptor. 4 men emerged. One had his arm in a sling. He looked on and cheered the other 3.
Jessery and I both looked at Leo, who took our meaning immediately.
"Useless. Useless," he said.
"What was useless?"
Cord asked. The sound of her voice caused Archibald to look up. Leo was not the sort to care that we had a visitor, but he did answer her question.
"My vlore. All of the Vale lore I have ever studied."
"It can't have been that bad," Jessery exclaimed.
Which was funny, since over the years, no one had been more persistent than Jessery in telling Leo how useless his vlore was. By way of an answer, Leo rolled to his feet, glided over, grasped the edge of Jessery's hood, and yanked it down. Not only was Jessery now blind, but because of how the bolt was wound around his body, it interfered with his arms and made it surprisingly difficult for him to expose his face again. Leo gave him the tiniest of nudges, and he lost his balance so badly that I had to hug him and force him upright.
"That's what they did to you?"
I asked.
Leo nodded. "Tilt your head back, not forward,"
Cord was saying to Archibald.
"There's a vein up here."
She pointed to the bridge of her nose.
"Pinch it." "That's right. My name is Cord. I am a Sib of Erasmus."
"Enchanted,"
Archibald said in a nasal tone now that he was pinching his nose.
"I am Archibald, bastard of the local Bayesian archprelate, if you can believe such a thing."
The bleeding is slowing down, I think, Cord said. From one of her pockets, she had drawn out a pair of purple wads which unfolded to gloves of some stretchy, membranous stuff. She wiggled her hands into them. I was baffled for a few moments, then realized that this was a precaution against infection, something I never would have thought of.
Fortunately, my blood supply is simply enormous because of my size,
Arcibald pointed out.
Otherwise, I fear I should exsanguinate.
Some of Cord's pockets were narrow and tall and ranked in neat rows. From two of these, she drew out blunt plugs of white fibrous stuff about the size of her little finger, with strings trailing from them.
What on earth are those?
Arcibald wanted to know. Blood-soaker uppers, Cord said. One for each nostril, if you would like. She gave them over into Arcibald's gory hands and watched, a little bit nervous and a little bit fascinated, as Arcibald gingerly put them in. Leo, Jessery, and I looked on, speechless. Sur Ayla came in with an armload of rags, most of which she threw on the floor to cover the blood puddle. She and Cord used the rest to wipe the blood off of Arcibald's lips and chin. The whole time they were appraising each other, as if in a competition to see which was the scientist and which was the specimen. By the time I got my wits about me to make introductions, they knew so much about each other that names hardly mattered. From yet another pocket, Cord produced a complex metal thing all folded in on itself. She evoluted it into a miniature scissors, which she used to snip off the strings dangling from Arcibald's nostrils. So bossy, so stern a person was Sur Ayla, that until this moment, I had feared that she and Cord were going to fall upon each other like two cats in a pillowcase. But when she drew focus on those blood-soaker uppers, she gave Cord a happy look, which Cord returned. We frog-marched Arcibald out of there, hid his carnage under a huge scarlet robe, and came out for Provener only a few minutes late. We were greeted by titters from some who assumed we'd been extramuros getting drunk. Most of these wags were apert visitors, but I heard amusement even from the thousanders. I was expecting that Jessery and I would have to do most of the work, but on the contrary, Leo and Arcibald pushed with far more than their usual strength. After Provener, the Warden Fendant crossed the chancel and came through our screen to interview Leo and Arcibald. Jessery and I stood off to one side. Cord stood close and listened. This influenced Leo to use a lot of fluckish to the annoyance of Fra Degalos. Arcibald, on the other hand, kept using words like rapscallions. From his description of the vehicle the thugs had driven and the clothes they had worn, Cord knew them. They are a local, she said, and stopped.
Gang?
Degalos offered. She shrugged.
A gang that keeps pictures of fictional gangs from old Spielies on their walls.
How fascinating, Arcibald proclaimed, while Fra Degalos was absorbing this detail.
It is, then, a sort of meta-gang.
But they still do gangy stuff for real, Cord said, as I don't have to tell you. It became clear from the nature of the questions Degalos asked that he was trying to work out which iconography the gang subscribed to. He did not seem to grasp something that was clear enough to me and Cord, namely that there were extras who would beat up Avout simply because it was more entertaining than not beating them up, not because they subscribed to some ridiculous theory of what we were. He was assuming that rapscallions bothered to have theories. Cord and I therefore became frustrated, then bored, and as Orlo liked to say, boredom is a mask that frustration wears. I caught her eye. We drifted to one side. When no one objected, we fled. As mentioned, we tenors had a bundle of turrets instead of a proper nave. The skinniest turret was a spiral stair that led up to the triforium, which was a sort of raised gallery that ran all the way around the inside of the chancel above the screens and below the soaring clerestory windows. At one end of our triforium was another little stair that led up to the bell ringer's place. Cord was interested in that. I watched her gaze traveling up the bell ropes to where they vanished into the heights of the presidium.
I could tell she wouldn't rest until she had seen what was at the other end of those ropes. So we went to the other end of the triforium and began to climb another stair. This one zigzagged up the tower that anchored the southwestern corner of the minster. Mathic architects were helpless when it came to walls. Pillars they could do. Arches they were fine with. Vaults, which were just three-dimensional arches, they knew everything about. But ask them to construct a simple wall, and they would go to pieces. Where anyone else in the world would construct a wall, they'd fill in the space with a system of arches and tracery. When people complained about wind, vermin, and other things that would be kept out of a normal building by walls, they might be troubled to fill up a vacancy with a stained glass window. But we hadn't got round to putting all of those in yet. On a windy and rainy day, it made buildings like this hellish. But on a day like this one, it was fine because you could always see. As we scaled the flights of the southwestern tower, we had views down into the minster and out over the Consent. The upper reaches of this tower, the place where it devolved into piers and pinnacles, the highest part, in other words, that you could get to without ladders and mountaineering equipment, was at about the same altitude as the Warden Regulant's headquarters. It sported one of the most elaborate works of stone carving in the whole Consent, a sort of cupola, tower, walk-through statue depicting planets and moons and some of the early cosmographers who had studied them. Built into the middle of this was a portcullis, a grid of bars that could be cranked up and down. At the moment, it had been drawn up out of the way, giving us the freedom to attack yet another stair. This one was cut right into the top of a flying buttress. It would take us up and inwards to the Presidium. If the portcullis had been closed, we'd have had nowhere else to go. Unless we wanted to cross over a sort of bridge into the Warden Regulant's quarters.